Hello, and welcome to Learning for Life at Gustavus, the podcast about people teaching and learning at Gustavus Adolphus College, and the myriad ways that Gustavus liberal arts education provides a lasting foundation for lives of fulfillment and purpose. I'm your host, Greg Castor, faculty member in the Department of History. DNA. We've all heard of it and may even know a bit about it. It is, forgive me, part of the DNA of our popular culture. But RNA? Not so much, though by the end of this conversation, you will know more. My guest today, Dr. Jeff Dalside of the Biology and Chemistry Departments at Gustavus, devotes a lot of time to thinking about and researching messenger RNA, or mRNA, specifically the wonderfully named, quote, nonsense-mediated mRNA decay, or NMD, which he'll help us make sense of shortly. A 1990 cum laude graduate of Gustavus, where he majored in chemistry and minored in biology, Professor Dalside earned his PhD in biochemistry, molecular biology, and cell biology from Northwestern University. He returned to his alma mater as a faculty member in 2002, following a stint at St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota. Jeff teaches courses in biochemistry, biology, cell and molecular biology, proteins, and genetics, and directs the biochemistry molecular biology program at Gustavus. Over the years, he has mentored numerous undergraduates in research and presented and published in various scholarly venues, including with students. Along with internal funding, his work has been supported by the National Science Foundation, Project Kaleidoscope, and the W.M. Keck Foundation, the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, and Merck and the American Association for the Advancement of Science. He is passionate about undergraduate science education, as well as quite thoughtful about matters of institutional import, and I've been looking forward to this conversation with him. So, Jeff, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Greg. I've been looking forward to this as well.
Thanks so much. We've crossed paths on some committees and got to know you a bit better that way. But I've really been looking forward to learning more about you and your work. Before we dive into that, let me just say for listeners, if you hear hammering, pounding, drilling, it's because I'm recording in my the den of the condo where downtown Minneapolis, where I live with my wife, Kate, and dear neighbors, friends, they're engaging in a remodel, so we may hear some noise, but we'll just power through that. So how did, Jeff, how did it go in the fall? You were teaching in the fall, and what was that like with COVID? And maybe in the spring as well, I guess you were doing that probably.
Yeah, I think it was a time of steep learning curves for faculty, jumping into a new set of technologies to engage students remotely. I think, you know, the students here are really good with, is when you put a earnest effort forward, they give you a lot of grace to try new things and, have some failures and pick up and try again. But I think it went pretty well. It helped in the fall. I think that we knew a little bit ahead of time what was coming and right. So that we could, brace for it and plan for it a little bit better. The spring was a little more chaotic. But both times I've had good groups of students. And you know, we've been trying to make the best out of it. And, I think we did.
Yeah. I never taught online before. Had you done that?
No, I never had.
Yeah. And I had the same experience. Every faculty member at Gustavus I've spoken with has, kind of echoed you and been my experience as well. The students, for the most part, right? The students rose to the occasion. And I felt really, you know, genuine learning was going on as good as there would be in person, although it's not the same, obviously.
Right.
And I did feel good about it. And I learned a great deal. And some of it I'll probably continue even when we're back in person. So, you know, yeah, the question I have for you, go ahead. What was that?
Oh, I was going to say likewise. It was good to learn some things that I can put to use in the future.
Yeah, no, same here. What about, you know, I wondered about scientists and their labs. Did you do labs virtually or how did that work?
Yeah, we employed a couple different strategies. This fall, I had a section of the capstone course for the biochemistry major where we do semester-long investigative projects. And there's a planning stage to that. So while we were kind of in the remote period, the first few weeks, we engaged students in that planning work. Okay. And so then with the idea that then once we were able to convene on campus, they were ready to roll with their plans. So it shortened the number of weeks we actually had for hands-on work, but we emphasized that the planning as part of good doing good science anyway. And so we just drilled down a little bit harder on that and took advantage of the opportunity that sort of the distance learning enforced on us.
That's fantastic. I love that. Right. That planning. Yes. This is what we need to do anyway. Oh, that's right. Great.
And then in some of the other classes we had, we took kind of a A group, B group strategy where we had kind of every other week, half the lab was engaged in lab with hands-on in order to allow for the distancing requirements. And then the other half, we found space in other places where they could work on the sort of post-lab data analysis, scientific writing, and the other skills that we try to emphasize in the lab curriculum.
That's all great. And this just, again, reminds me, you know, maybe I should stop reading the Chronicle of Higher Ed and some other industry publications, because they're filled with, you know, how things are not going well. But in fact, you know, I mean, there's a lot of good stuff happening, even, you know, even amid these challenging, awful circumstances.
Yeah.
As we all adapt and are creative. You know, there's so much I want to ask you about you and about science at Gustava. So let's start with you. Tell us a little bit about your background, where you grew up, and why you wound up at Gustava.
Yeah. So I was born and raised in Fergus Falls, Minnesota. So it's kind of the west central part of the state. It was the place that my parents landed after their education, and they are both public educators, retired now, and they found both jobs in Fergus Falls, and so settled there. I heard a lot about Gustava growing up because my parents went to school at Gustava.
Oh,
they actually met there. After, as sort of along the way, as was more common in those days, they got married while they were students. That resulted in kind of the deal they made with, at least as the story goes, with my grandfather, is that if my mother would switch to Minnesota State Mankato and the tuition drop, would save him money that he could use to pay for the wedding. So it's kind of a fun
a great story.
So she finished there, and my dad continued at Gustava. And then after that and some student teaching, they ended up in Fergus Falls.
Yeah, I'm always amazed at the number of people who go to Gustava who have you know, sometimes ancestors, not just like parents, but, you know, great grandparents.
Yeah.
Who went, was that the case with you, or was it just your parents?
It was my parents. And then my dad had an older brother that, went here in advance of him and then went on to dentistry. And they were both first generation, college students. And so that's really where it began for my lineage anyway.
That's great. What were your parents studying? Was it science or?
So, my dad was studying science. He was, it was initially thinking that he wanted to kind of follow the pattern of his older brother and pursue dentistry. According to him, his interest in the fraternity life kind of dashed his grades and changed his plans. And so he ended up looking at doing science education. And so his major was in biology, but at the time, the certification scheme for high school science was sort of a broad high school science certification. So that's what he finished with, is a biology major with science education certification. And then my mom pursued elementary education.
So yeah, educators in your family.
Yeah.
Did you consider any other schools, or was Gustava it?
I think in the end, I ended up maybe applying to three different schools, maybe having looked at a few more within the upper Midwest. So it kind of came down to St. John's in Collegeville, Luther College in Decorah, and then Gustava.
And we won out. Good.
And Gustava won out.
Yeah. Happy for us.
Yeah.
What, did you, Did you know already that you were going to major in some scientific discipline? I mean, it was in your case chemistry, or how did you come to the chemistry major?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I don't know. I remember a big influence was this paper that I wrote in high school on recombinant DNA technology, and that led me. That inspired me. That sort of learning about how genes could be spliced together and unspliced and recombined. And so when I came to Gustavus, I think it was my interest to learn more about that, and started with biology and chemistry. And through kind of the advising that I got through the time, we didn't then have a biochemistry and molecular biology major at Gustavus.
Right.
So following the guidance of the advisors that I had, I ended up majoring in chemistry with enough biology to kind of create maybe something functionally equivalent.
Were there professors that at Gustavus had a particular impact on your learning?
Yeah, the professors I had in biology and chemistry, they did and it was kind of fun in terms of returning to the faculty to be able to then teach as colleagues alongside some of the very ones that inspired me to go on beyond Gustavus. So on the biology side of things, it was John Lammert, Bill Heidkamp, and Colleen Jacks. And they were still on the faculty when I returned to Gustavus as faculty. And then on the chemistry side, it was Larry Potts, Alice Flickerber, and Brian O'Brien.
Oh, really? Brian, too?
I
got to. Brian came, I think, came to Gustavus about a year before me, before Kate and me, and we got to know him and just recorded a podcast with him. Brian's awesome. Larry Potts, I still talk to now virtually, mostly through Facebook. But because of his interest in genealogy, that's amazing. And Colleen went to Gustavus. I don't know about I'm not sure any of the others.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't think so either. But they're all you know, they were major figures in the faculty when Kate and I came. I guess Colleen was hired after we came. Kate might have been on her search committee actually. Anyway, the sciences are so were so strong and still are. We can maybe come back to that later when we talk about how you think things have changed at Gustavus. So were you, how did it work? Were you sort of on the graduate school track from early on at Gustavus?
No, I don't know that I knew a whole lot about what the steps right after graduation were going to be for me when I started. I work with a lot of students now that come in with a pretty laser focus and a sense of their trajectory well beyond Gustavus. And I'm always kind of stunned and amazed at the apparent foresight they have. For me, I was interested in learning more and kind of taking advantage of the college experience and seeing where it led. And so I think it was really the combination of being inspired by learning in the field that drew my passion and some of my experience as teaching assistants and for laboratory sections while a student here that helped connect for me what it might look like to pursue my academic interests and teaching in the form of a career. And so, having public educators as parents, a lot of value in education, the importance of learning, lifelong learning. They really kind of swallowed that pill. It was a big emphasis in my household, to the extent of we were discouraged from having jobs outside of high school. Because it was more important to be focusing on our learning and taking advantage of the learning opportunities, curricular and co-curricular, that were available. So friends who had cars, but then had to have jobs to make the payments on the cars. And it was just one of those things that was not encouraged.
That's to me, that's a great gift. And it's something I'm grateful still to this day to my parents for. I remember vividly one of my best friends in high school. His dad was the biology teacher. Mm-hmm. And I actually had him in biology. I can still remember him holding up a frog, and the frog suddenly peeing, live frog peeing on the people in the first row. Anyway, but one of the things that biology teacher Mr. Ray Giannata said to my dad, I'll never forget this, was that. As I was going to go to Northern Illinois University, he said something like, you know, to my dad, college or something like that will be his full-time job. And so I was not required or expected by my parents to work during the, during the school year, just to focus on the academics, which I'm so grateful for. I mean, what a difference that can make. Because some of our students have to work, not just at Gustavus, but elsewhere. And they really juggle a lot. So
amazing, really.
Yeah, no kidding. I agree. Just before we turn to graduate school, but just briefly. So were there other or courses in other disciplines you enjoyed out of the sciences at Gustavus?
I took some American history.
Really? Was that with Kevin or Kevin Byrne?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Kevin who hired us, yeah.
Yeah, and it was sort of one semester for the, general ed requirement, but liked it, so took a second semester.
Yeah.
So that was fun. Out of that grew an interest in sort of the literature that was being written in America at the time. Uh-huh. And so I took American Lit 2.
Oh, yeah.
In the later stages of my time at Gustavus. I had a fun course on Finland. Taught by Roger McKnight. And I had been an exchange student in high school to Finland.
Oh.
And so it was kind of one of these unexpected boons that comes, like many people, I think, experience when they go to a liberal arts college, is here I had this exchange experience, and then I had a chance to take a course on the country, and the culture of the country. And I think I learned as much or more in the course than I did when I was an exchange student. Right. I mean, it just added pound for pound, my appreciation. And so that was fun to kind of connect.
That's great. Both Roger and Kevin now, emeritus, I retired, but really, amazing professors. I want to go to Finland. Kate and I have been watching all these Scandinavian noir crime detective shows. Yeah. I want to go to Finland, Iceland, Denmark, Sweden, anyway, one day.
Yeah.
That's really cool. Why Finland in high school? How did that come about?
That came about because the U.S. Senate sponsors an exchange with Finland from the five states with the highest degree of immigration from Finland.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And they have a scholarship program. And the exchange program that administers it is called Youth for Understanding. And so Minnesota happens to be one of those five states. And I was encouraged in high school by my guidance counselor to give it a try. Why don't you apply? And so I did. And I ended up winning the scholarship. And that's how, I don't know if I would have singled out Finland. I don't know if I would have even considered going abroad in high school otherwise.
Yeah. Yeah. That's fantastic. Were you able to go abroad while at Gustavus or not?
I was not. Yeah. The financial constraints for me at the time where I didn't have to work outside of my work study assignment, but going abroad was out of the question.
Yeah. But you had that experience coming in and then were able to build on it. That's great.
Exactly.
I was able to go to Mexico for a semester I was a junior undergrad, and just still, that experience still informs me, as I'm sure your experience in Finland does in some ways. Have you been back to Finland at all?
I have not. I did. While we were there, we had some opportunity to travel. So I ended up, this is before the Berlin Wall came down. But to go to Leningrad.
Oh, wow.
And so that was kind of interesting, trip, going through border stations and kind of very orchestrated visit, but it was getting to see some really different kinds of country and living experiences.
Retracing Lenin's footsteps or something. Yeah. That's awesome. The so from Gustavus, you went to Northwestern. I just know, having grown up in the south suburbs of Chicago, just know how, I love the campus. I love the lakefront, all that. But anyway, what was it about Northwestern that, that drew you there?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I ended up kind of considering three graduate programs, one in the University of Wisconsin-Madison, Michigan in Ann Arbor, and then Northwestern. And it kind of came down to between Michigan and Northwestern. I was absolutely captivated by Ann Arbor. I thought that would be just the coolest city to be a grad student in, and not as keen on the heavily urban sort of seeming for this small town Minnesota guy, north end of Chicago. But their program really was the best fit. It was if you could imagine it, kind of a liberal arts inspired program in biomolecular science. Wow. So they just had a broad range of folks there doing interesting work, from the kind of extreme physical side of biophysical science, all the way through to just some really interesting genetics and everything in between. And so I think the diversity and a range of opportunities there fit well with the kind of broad curiosity that the liberal arts cultivates, and was certainly something that I still have, just really have an appreciation for all kinds of questions, right?
Right. You do. I mean, there's no question about that. We'll come back to that too. That sounds like a great program. That's the sort of program I find very, just hearing about makes me excited. So was it a 4-year program, or how long does it take to do a PhD in your field?
Yeah, they kind of range. 4 would be really, really quick. Typical, I think, in my field would be sort of in the range of 5 to 7 years. Some programs are known for holding their students longer, like Caltech in particular, like is one of those. It's known more for the 7-year timeframe. When I was recruited by the program, they were talking about trying to keep those numbers reasonable. And I ended up finishing in 4.5 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. So
the second person in my program to finish up. And the one in front of me had the advantage, I think, of some maturity from having worked in industry first, and knowing why he was there. And he just buckled down and plowed through. And then there was, then I was the next to come along.
That's impressive. I think I, in history, it's, I don't know what it is these days. It used to be sort of 5 to 8. I think I took 8. I mean, I wasn't finished when I started, the position at Gustavus, which I wish I had been. I didn't finish for another 3 years, I think, but wow. That's fast. That's really fast.
Yeah.
Good for you. I find this, I mean, I just love that phrase, nonsense mediated mRNA decay. But in as best you can in layperson's sense, and you're talking to someone I think I've only had one chemistry course in my whole life, and that was high school, I'm embarrassed to say, which I loved. In fact, all the, what are those aptitude tests said I should be a chemist, but I became a historian instead. Anyway, what exactly what is your research about? Let's just start there. Okay. Tell us what you do.
I'll give it a try.
Great.
So I study, what I study in a model, a single cellular organism, baker's yeast or brewer's yeast. The simplicity of the system helps, and it also has a tremendous sort of set of experimental tools available to it as well. But in that simple system, it also allows to kind of explain the research question, because we don't have the added complexity of multicellularity. Okay. So if you imagine just one eukaryotic cell, so cells with nuclei, the information archive is the set instructions encoded in the genome, the genomic DNA in the nucleus. And so anytime the cell needs to carry out some kind of function, it needs to tap into the information content in that genome. And the process by which it does that, geneticists would say that it expresses its genes.
Okay.
And at a molecular level, what that means is it goes, it starts in the nucleus with the DNA, and the information content of this this polymer of four different sort of the alphabet of DNA has four characters. And so it makes a copy of that information in the sister molecule, ribonucleic acid or RNA. Mm-hmm. Which has an analogous set of sort of alphabet, four characters. And then that RNA molecule then leaves the nucleus as an instruction set for making the protein that will then carry out some kind of cellular function.
Okay. So part of what you're doing is looking at proteins, right? Is that right?
Ultimately, the end product of gene expression would be the production of some kind of protein.
Okay.
That would then, you know, fold and carry out some function in the cell, enzymatic activity. It could be embedded in the cell membrane to have transport nutrients from the outside to the inside. It could be a structural component to give sort of shape and structure to the cell.
Okay.
So in a generic sense anyway. And but for any one of those proteins that the cell might need, and Baker's yeast is estimated to have about 6,200 different genes with corresponding proteins. And and so anytime any one of those needs to be made, this process of making an RNA copy of the information in DNA, moving that RNA out of the nucleus into the cytoplasm of the cell, that would need to be done. And then there's a set of enzymatic components called ribosomes that engage the RNA molecule as sort of an instruction template to guide the joining of the building blocks of proteins together, amino acids. And so that's where we think about the genetic code, the way in which the four letters in the alphabet of DNA and RNA are correspond to specifying particular amino acids in particular order.
And well, first of all, is this something you observe through a microscope? Is that, or how do you?
We can see the end output of protein production sometimes with microscopy. We do a fair bit of molecular experiments where we're sort of breaking cells open and extracting either the RNA molecules or the protein molecules and using various laboratory techniques to analyze them. A lot of times running them through kind of a molecular sieve to separate them by size in a process called electrophoresis, and then trying to identify them or detect their abundance. And so sort of in that process, one of the things that my interests have focused in on is sort of how the abundance of the RNA molecule is manipulated by the cell in order to manipulate the amount of protein that's available.
Okay.
And so if you're at a point in cell process where you need a little bit of protein or you need a whole lot of protein, the cell responds to its environment and those demands and changes how much it makes. And that's all a tightly regulated and orchestrated process. And one of the steps that it is regulated along the way is regulating the amount of RNA. And in particular, looking at it from the point of view of how rapidly the RNA is degraded does affect how much RNA is available to be able to instruct the production of protein.
It's so cool, so interesting, so amazing. And by the way, I'm happy. I have to say some of these terms are coming back to me from maybe my high school biology. But in any case, like recombinant DNA. But what about, these are processes, are they just happening all the time? And are they, I mean, like happening virtually instantaneously? Do you have any idea how fast these processes occur?
Yeah. One of the statistics that I share with my students is that, like, if now this would be quite rapid, but in the context of bacterial, so this would be cells without nuclei, okay, for protein production, for a protein of about 100 amino acids long, it'd take about 5 seconds to produce the protein.
That's so incredible.
Yeah. And the process of making copies of DNA, I remember, did this in grad school. I was using this product for DNA sequencing, and it involved making copies of DNA with an enzyme called DNA polymerase. And so there was something on the packaging of the product about how quickly it could assemble the building blocks of DNA over time. And so I remember thinking, well, I wonder what that translates into, like, miles per hour. Great. So I got the metrics involved. You know, I had to translate from nanometers up to miles, and it turns out that those polymerases, if they're moving along sort of a linear, you know, chain of these alphabetic characters of DNA, you know, it moves faster than the speed of sound.
Oh my God.
So, you know, just to think that, like, we have these little, you know, sound barrier breaking crashes in our cells going all the time.
Yeah. It's extraordinary. One of the things that's happened to me since teaching at Gustavus, and it's, I think it's in large part, well, it's from the Nobel Conference, our annual Nobel Conference, and also listening, as I am now, listening to scientist colleagues like you, I have a much greater awareness of all the stuff that's going on inside my body, you know.
Yeah, whether you like it or not.
Yeah, exactly. I'll never forget the, was the Nobel Conference maybe on the, if it was on the brain, I'm not sure that what that's what it was called, but where we could hear one of the speakers, you know, plays this video, and you can just hear all of the electrical stuff happening inside. It was, you know, absolutely, literally, I mean, I guess pun intended, mind boggling. You know, that's so cool. The speed of sound. And I love that. I don't know if only a scientist, but certainly a scientist would say, how can I figure out what that would be in miles per hour? So what is it? What is this phrase nonsense mediated?
So it's a curious nomenclature, but, so the pathway that I study for how RNA is degraded is known for accelerating the degradation of an RNA molecule from what its normal rate of degradation might be. So it speeds it up, and then the net effect on the sort of pool of that particular RNA would be lowered. So it's kind of like, if you think about the water level in the sink in, you know, in the morning in the bathroom, you're getting washed up. You've got the input flow from the faucet. And then if you have the drain partially stoppered, then the water leaves at a faster or slower rate, right? And sort of lowering the overall level in the sink. So that's kind of what we're looking at, is that degradation rate or the removal rate. And the nonsense term comes from how the pathway was first discovered, in that RNA molecules that carry a mutation, a mistake, if you will, that essentially has the protein making process terminate prematurely from normal because the code has been changed and it inserts the signal for a stop before it gets to the normal position for a stop. That particular codon in genetic terms is referred to as a nonsense codon.
Okay. I love these terms in disciplines and the origins of them.
Yeah, isn't it interesting? Yeah. So like a normal, an amino acid specifying codon would be considered a sense codon. And then if it's changed from making sense, it then becomes nonsense.
All right. Well, I'm going to start yelling at my body to stop the nonsense and start making more sense or something. I mean, that's so amazing. Is there a practical or are there practical applications of your research? You mentioned gene splicing. I mean, that's certainly important.
Yeah, we use that technology routinely in the laboratory. The practical applications would be distal to the research that's immediate to my lab. So we're clearly in the camp of basic research where we're using kind of a model system with baker's yeast. We're not really looking to improve the ability of bakers to raise bread or brewers to make beer but rather just get at the fundamentals of understanding, and that then trusting that in the research apparatus for biomolecular science as a whole, that the impact on human health and welfare will follow. And there's some pretty good examples, particularly with baker's yeast, where that has occurred. In particular, there was a Nobel Prize that went for to Lee Hartwell and colleagues, Paul Nurse, for a genetic screen that they did, where they attempted to uncover all the genes that would be involved in controlling the cell division cycle. And they did that using these model systems of yeasts. And it turned out then, once they had identified those genes, that all of those genes, or most of those genes, had analogs in the human system. And they were the very genes in many cases that were misfunctioning in cancer.
Wow.
And so where we had kind of the skeleton of how the whole cell controls its division cycle revealed by such efforts, then when we were looking at human health conditions where the cell division cycle had gone wild, we were able to make the connections there and see how the basic research informed human health in direct ways.
That is so cool. I am never going to look at a package or packet of yeast anyway again. I love that. I'm thinking too about our colleague Margaret Block Quasi and her work on like the humble fruit fly, what can come of that. It's very cool. And this is a nice segue actually, since you're describing the kind of basic research you're doing, but to your I don't know what the right word is, partnership, collaboration with students. Tell us a little bit about that, what it's like to, I know your other, everyone in the science does this and some of us in humanities too, but to collaborate with students, to work with students on research. And you've done, I don't know, like at least three dozen, or starting at Olaf and continuing at Gustavus. What's that process like? What do you enjoy about it?
Yeah. Sharing the thrill of the pursuit and even just the elemental curiosity with, sort of emerging scholars as you kind of engage in looking at questions deeply and seriously in the laboratory. The model for training in science and my field in particular, but I would say science-wide, is kind of the apprenticeship model. It follows that certainly there's kind of the knowledge component, right? The content that someone has to acquire to kind of have a good understanding of the field. But when it comes down to actually then practicing inquiry, there's a whole set of, really practical tools, more like work that a mechanic might do compared to a scholar in some ways. And so you have to just get in the lab and roll up your sleeves and sort of apprentice students into those practices. And so it's a very close relationship kind of inquiry, working shoulder to shoulder, a lot of demonstration. It's kind of like show once, watch once, and then they're on their own. And then, come and ask me if you have questions. So there's kind of a maturing that happens there, just to learn the methodologies. And then of course, methodologies by themselves leave you kind of a technician level, but to move then more toward the scholar level, you need to begin to understand how do you ask questions and how do you pursue those questions using a scientific method so that you can interpret results with some confidence.
And you've just had some amazing experiences in students. I'm thinking about Abby Trouth, who I think won the Goldwater Scholarship, right? And maybe 2019, and a woman named Sarah Graves. Tell us a little bit about some of the students themselves that you've worked with, like Abby and Sarah.
Yeah, I remember meeting Abby as a prospective student. She and her mom were visiting campus. She was already very seriously science-minded, asking, you know, as a prospective student about research opportunities for her students early in their career. And she was one of our presidential scholar interviewees. And then right away when she was in her first semester, then she came by came by my office and said, "Remember me?" You know, and started asking about research opportunities. And so here it was, you know, we had claimed to have these. Now let's see that put into action, right? Yeah. So we, I worked with my colleague Scott Burr to get Abby into the lab for the first January term that she was on campus. And she just dove right in and was, part of her experience was, you know, finding that she was kind of in over her head in the deep end, as we sometimes say. And that's a pretty normal part of the experience. And then just to have that kind of normalized for her through the coaching that she got from Dr. Burr, especially, and myself some, to kind of understand that you're often feeling out of your depth when you're asking scientific questions.
Right.
And that persistence is a big part of it, and that you just need to hang on, and it starts to come together.
That's such an important lesson for students. And I think no matter the discipline, I mean, everything you just said, it applies to history. I know it applies to any discipline, any discipline where someone is doing research, right? And that's that feeling of, you know, it's uncomfortable, it's scary, you're in over your head.
What are people going to think?
Mm-hmm. What was that?
What are people going to think? And can I convince them?
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Right. Is this, you know, and yeah, do I want to continue? Does this really matter? Some of that just, I don't know, that's just being a graduate student working on a dissertation, but right. I think that's all really important. And then she won the Goldwater, which is really a prestigious award. What is she doing now? Do you know?
She ended up, she's gone on to graduate school and is actually, interestingly, she and I never did research together. I helped her get into that research experience in her first January term, and I've had her in class. She's actually pursuing study in RNA.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. She's in University of Colorado in Denver.
I'm trying to think of how to make a terrible joke about messenger RNA getting to her from you or something.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. What about, these are just, you know, students, I know you could talk about others and feel free to, but another student I came across in preparing for the podcast today was Sarah Graves. What is her story?
Yeah, Sarah's an interesting one where she came to me later in her time at Gustavus, where she just a real go-getter and very interested in science and the pursuit of science. A lot of these folks come in with a pretty deep interest in medicine initially. Some find themselves sticking with that in terms of looking at medical practice. In her case, the arc moved toward pursuit of research, more of a kind of a translational medical research orientation. But she had gotten herself into research opportunities off campus, first at the University of Michigan. Oh, wow. And then at the Mayo Clinic. But as she kind of was looking at the, I guess it was the before and after the summer that she went to the Mayo Clinic, she had time on her hands and wanted to do some more research. So she came by and asked if I had projects in my lab, and so we got started on some new directions that I was looking at, the RNA degradation for some genes that we hadn't had time to analyze yet. And I think she's probably the single most productive student I've ever had in lab. She just dug in through a January term in the spring semester, did a huge amount of work, then went off to Mayo for the summer, did research there, and then came back and kind of pushed through to draw our project really nicely together in the fall. She ended up graduating early, so 3.5 years, and then jetted over back to Mayo, where she had an offer from the lab that she had worked in the prior summer to continue doing work, and then started graduate school there. And so she's in her graduate studies there.
That's just fantastic. Yeah. Wow. It's got to be so gratifying to work with those. Well, I know it is. I mean, obviously, to work with those kinds of students and then see them. One of the things I love is just seeing what alums wind up doing.
Yeah.
You know, I love that so much, and keeping up with them as you have with Sarah and Abby, and I know so many others. This leads me to a kind of a big question. I'm asking because I know how much you care about and think about your teaching. And that's reflected in some of the, you know, the grants you've received and been part of. But what do you think, what are the ingredients of really, you know, excellent science education? And you can come at that from the vantage point of a professor or student or both, if you like.
Sure. Well, it is a huge question.
I know it's a huge question. Yeah.
I think there's a tendency to go toward content in that conversation often by professionals. What do you need to know to be able to do, to accomplish, to demonstrate that you've, you know, obtained an excellent education?
Yes.
And I would say that in terms of the teaching side of that, certainly in the case of science, and I think you probably argue this for history, that to really get a top flight education, you should have some practice in the discipline.
Right.
As part of kind of finishing at least a major, right. Outside of, you know, just maybe a general education exposure.
Yes.
And so that, I think that's where our laboratory experiences come into play. Traditionally those were, kind of more oriented to be illustrative of what is done in science, and increasingly like the current leading edge right now is really to engage students in the practice of science authentically through our laboratory experiences. And so that, I think about that in the context of providing freedom within bounds for students. Mm-hmm. And on the earlier stages of the curriculum, there's more bounds and less freedom. And they might be learning more methods that are basic or foundational. But then as they go through the curriculum, it should become more and more freedom and fewer bounds to kind of the ultimate would be that research collaborative experience where you're really engaging in an unbounded way, authentic research. You keep pressing until you get the answer.
Yeah.
And it's not bounded by like even a semester long research project in the context of a course is bounded by the fact right. that we have to turn grades in at some point, right?
Yes.
So it has to come to some kind of conclusion and is time bound in that case. So, but engaging students then in the actual practice well above and beyond the content and sort of thinking about the content piece, I think that sciences have shifted to become more and more like how we think about the field of law, where to become a practitioner in law, you don't know all of law. You get your law degree and then you kind of dig down and become an expert. Right.
Right.
And so you practice law. You don't know all of law.
Yes.
And I think an old paradigm for the sciences was to be a chemist or to be a biologist meant that you knew all of chemistry. And that's just simply impossible these days.
Right.
With how much we know. And so I think the paradigm is shifting to that you practice chemistry or you practice molecular biology.
Yes.
And you can't possibly know all of it. And so then there's, I mean, it makes the liberal arts background a great preparation for it because you're really learning how to learn at a really high level. And so as your career continues to demand that of you, you continue to either find collaborators who know what you need to know and work with them and learn from them, or you become somewhat of an expert yourself by, you know, picking it up and learning.
Yeah, that's all of this is making me excited and smiling, because it's exactly the same shift that's occurred in the history discipline, and maybe across the academy, where, you know, we talk now about thinking historically, right? What does it mean to think historically? You know, in other words, it's the old coverage versus skills, whatever you want to phrase, attention. And certainly in my teaching I do a lot less worrying now about, oh my God, I need to cover this, I need to cover that, as an educator and has a history background. Sam Weinberg, who came to Gustavus years ago, has put it in his latest book, you know, why study history when it's on your iPhone, right? I mean, you know, there's all this information, it's too much information, and the information is readily available, and a lot of the information is garbage. So it's more important to know how to find information, how to process it, how to tell, you know, good information from junk information, et cetera. But yeah, exact same thing, less about content. Not that content isn't important, of course, right, but
exactly
about the practice, as you said, the practice. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think then when it comes around to teaching, for me, at least, one of the things that was always inspiring as a student was the authenticity of the engagement I had with my instructor, right? What was true and real about them? What was inspiring? Their passion, their knowledge, their skills, their ability, their excitement. And so I think about, Parker Palmer writes about the classroom or the teaching profession as being sort of at the intersect of the public and the private. And I think it's easy to become sort of uber professional about it and distance our engagement in a less authentic way with students, sometimes even just for self-preservation. But I think the real mojo lies at showing up authentically for our students.
Yeah, all well said. And you're reminding me, boy, Parker Palmer, I don't know if he came to Gustavus, but at some point, maybe a group of us reading, I don't remember the title, but his book about teaching, The Courage to Teach, maybe, yes, something like
that's
that.
Correct.
Yeah, which definitely had an impact on me, as it's had on so many. Wow, that's all incredibly well said and important. The other thing, you know, you kind of, in a way, touched on this when you were mentioning, you know, your experience as a student just a minute ago. Mm-hmm. What's your sense of how things have changed at Gustavus? I know that's a big question, but are there any things that really stand out all these years later from when you graduated?
Yeah, that is a huge question. It's a hard one to know how to tackle. I think about even from the time I've been on the faculty at Gustavus, I might say, well, which Gustavus are you referring to?
Yes, that's good. that's an answer.
Yeah. Because it's really been and continues to progress as an institution, right?
Right.
And so that with that change, then the you know, there are some things that stay true.
Yes.
And then there are some things that really kind of change. So I would say that some of the things that have changed from the time that I was a student to the present probably track the STEM fields as a whole, in that this emphasis on practice is more supported and facilitated these days than it was when I was a student, in terms of, in particular, the undergraduate research experiences being an important and integral part of more students' experience.
And by supported, you mean it's really funded, right, by external?
Yeah, I think things in like changes in the number of contact hours that faculty have with students, so that the teaching load is more accommodating of having additional time to work with students in the research laboratory.
Yes.
I think, you know, like when I was a student here, I'll bet you that, Larry Potts and Bill Heidkamp and company that I named earlier, you know, we're probably looking at 18 contact hours a semester instead of 12.
Right.
And it's hard to have time to do as much research with students when that's the teaching load. And so sure. I think some of those things have come along.
Yes.
Our new facilities, obviously, are a pretty exciting addition to that repertoire of resources.
Yes. I mean, Nobel, my God, the new Nobel. I know it's what, remodeled, expanded. It's incredible. It's just amazing.
It's really like totally a different facility from what it was in some way.
Yeah.
And I think it came off to great effect in that, like, my location in the space now is in the new space that was added to the south end of the existing building. But as you move into the renovated original Nobel, it's just seamless in design. So you can't really tell which is old and which is new. And yet there's enough features that are recognizable from the past that you can kind of see, oh, that's kind of like what it was before. Yeah. And yet it's an entirely new facility.
Yeah. I walked through, let's see, and I also sat in on a class there, one of your colleagues in biology. And, you know, aside from the awesome facilities for the scientists, the professors and the students, it's a dream come true for me because I used to fantasize about having pastry carts and coffee, you know, places, not just in one location, but, you know, various locations around campus. And when I walk in and I see there's a coffee and pastries place right there in the business in the big lobby. Easy.
Yeah,
that's it. Wow, I was just like, this is incredible. Yeah. But the facilities, you know, there's continuity for sure, but the campus center that was built after the tornado in 98, the new Nobel, the way that social science, that building has been refurbished and made really beautiful and I think more functional. And then also, there have always been great professors and dedicated professors at Gustavus from the get-go. I think it seems that the faculty is a bit more, maybe a lot more even, diverse, and I don't mean just in terms of, you know, ethnic and racial background, but in terms of geographic background as well. But
yeah.
I didn't attend, as listeners, regular listeners know, you may know, I didn't attend a liberal arts college. My wife did. She attended Bard College. But I just love, one thing that stayed the same is that I think there's a lot of freedom at Gustavus for faculty and students alike to explore, which I mean, look, at a lot of schools, I wouldn't even be doing a podcast, right? Forget it.
You'd
be,
right.
But just to be able to do the kind of teaching and learning we're all able to do is truly, it's a blast. I mean, yeah, there's grading. There's always the, you know, that goes without saying.
Right.
But it's mostly just a blast. I think I really, really enjoy it so much. The other thing I wanted to ask you is and I should have asked this maybe much earlier, is to offer us a definition of biochemistry. You're the director of that program. What is biochemistry about? And then what's your pitch for the biochem molecular biology program at Gustavus?
Yeah, so the title of our program is Biochemistry and Molecular Biology. And I find myself in talking with prospective students, current students, outside constituents, really referring to it as the field of biomolecular science, kind of like we maybe use the term neuroscience. It's really quite a broad field. It starts when you lean toward things biological from chemistry and continues all the way over toward the molecular sides and even cellular sides of biology. So it's quite a broad field. It has intersects with other fields that we would know by name, like immunology and neuroscience. And so the program here, I think, is strong in three regards. I think we're distinct, we're robust, and we're flexible. Mm-hmm. And by that, I mean the program is distinct in particular by being jointly created by the biology and chemistry departments here. And that sort of origin story for the program means that it started so in such a way that it, the program itself could live at the center of the two departments or the continuum between of the field between those two points. Whereas a lot of places will have a second major in biochemistry either offered out of the biology department or the chemistry department. And so then the net effect is you get kind of a flavored degree. So in our case, I think we can celebrate the whole continuum between biology and chemistry because of that, that origin and the centristic sort of orientation of the program. I think we're robust in that we have give students a great grounding in the foundations of the disciplines, lots of opportunity to practice, and we develop lots of transferable liberal arts learning gains. And then I think the last part would be that we're flexible with the way the program is structured. We really prioritize helping students land where they're supposed to or where they need to land, which we I think do through some very effective advising in chemistry, in biology, and in the program, so that it allows students to change majors when that's the appropriate thing to do, maybe from biochemistry to biology or chemistry, or maybe something else. And then within the program, we put some energy, especially through the capstone course, on vocational reflective activities to help students think deeply about where they're to land and what their gift set and the world's needs, how that those might intersect in ways that bring them happiness and impact.
I'm sold. I'm totally sold.
I'll sign you up.
You got me. You pretty much had me at the first point about why it's distinct, which I think is really, really, that is distinctive and important. And then you definitely had me at the end with the piece about, thinking about vocation beyond just, beyond just the major, right?
And right.
I could keep going as always. I'm just so it's so interesting and energizing to speak with you. And I'm going to have to go back and read some more about RNA and DNA. See, the way, even just the way that the DNA, the way that gets thrown around, right? We even some historians talk about slavery is the original sin, or slavery is in our country's DNA.
Right.
It's interesting and has interesting problematic implications. But Jeff, anyway, this was really fun and interesting. Thank you so much. Any prospective students listening, be sure you contact Professor Dalside and see if you're you've got this, you've got the right stuff to do some research with him. You'll be in good hands.
It's all nonsense.
Yeah, that would have been a great answer to my question. Yeah, what's your pitch? It's all nonsense. Oh wow, that's a good tagline. So take good care. Good luck. Well, no, you're on sabbatical this spring, right?
I am.
So good luck with that. And maybe at some point we can get together again in person, I hope, once we're vaccinated.
That would be lovely. This has been a total hoot, Greg.
Likewise, Jeff. Take good care. Thanks so much.
All right.
See you later. Bye-bye. Learning for Life at Gustavus is produced by J.J. Aiken and Matthew Dobosensky of the Gustavus Office of Marketing. Gustavus graduate Will Clark, class of 20, who also provides technical expertise to the podcast, and me. The views expressed in this podcast are not necessarily those of Gustavus Adolphus College.